myself a drink and ask you who you are, when all I wanted to do was talk to you. You ask me to dance and then you grope my breast, try to put your thigh between mine, you know the rest. When all I wanted to do was talk to you. Why the hell you think we're here? Forget we're lonely and drink down our fear. I smile at you, you say, where's she coming from? What is she up to? When all I wanted to do was talk to you. When you look at me, what is it you're seeing? I hope to God it's another human being who is lonely like you, and you might want to talk to.
This is Lesbian Nation, and I'm Martha Shelley. Tonight we're having interviews with two women, Carla J. and June Rook.
Why the hell you think we're here? Forget we're lonely and drink down our fear. I stand alone at the bar, buy myself a drink and ask you who you are, when all I wanted to do was talk to you. Talk to.
That was Maxine Feldman singing Bar One. This coming Sunday at GAA, there's going to be a panel on sadomasochism. Women only are invited. It's 2 p.m., and I assume there's the usual contribution. So if you are into sadomasochism or want to know what all of this business is about, come on down to the Firehouse, 99 Wooster Street, at 2 o'clock on Sunday. I am interviewing Carla J. and June Rook in my apartment down in the miserable old Lower East Side. And they have just come out with a book called Out of the Closets. Actually, it's edited by Carla J. and Alan Young, but I messed up my chance to interview him. Anyway, how did it happen?
The book?
Yeah.
Well, a couple of years ago, I saw all the women's liberation anthologies, and there were no gay liberation anthologies in the works or anywhere. And I thought that there should be a gay anthology, because I think that an anthology has the advantage of presenting a diversity of views rather than a line. And I wanted people to hear the multiplicity of voices in gay liberation rather than what I had to say on gay liberation or my opinion. And so Alan and I started collecting a lot of articles, and most of them are original articles, in the hopes of showing this diversity of radical views. That's the one thing they have in common. And a lot of the articles are articles which Alan and I disagree with.
You mean you disagree with the political points of view, but you thought it was important that they be expressed?
Right. I mean, for example, this one article, Dear Mom, about how one woman told her mother that she's gay. And her mother had a rather benign reaction. But I know people who have told their parents that they're gay, and their parents have thrown them out, have never seen them again. And I don't know, have disowned them, and I don't know whether it's really the thing that you have to do to tell your parents.
But I know of one kid who told her father, and nice, decent, upstanding religious parent that he was, he broke her nose and threw her out of the house.
Well, that's the type of thing I've heard of. I mean, that has to be taken into account, and she advises people in her article to tell your parents first. And she came out, I know her, she came out, and the first thing she did was she ran home and said, "Mother, I've got a lover," you know, and she wrote to her mother. And I don't think this works particularly in a lot of people's cases.
Well, maybe she knew her mother pretty well.
Maybe. A lot of people maybe should know their mothers better, you know, before they...
I'm curious about the way you organize this thing into chapters. You said before that that's something that makes this book different from other books. I don't follow it.
Well, I think that the books that have come out until now have basically been created to explain gay people to straight people, why we are the way we are, what gay liberation is. This book goes beyond that. This book was primarily written for gay people by gay people. This book is on where we're going, what our problems are as gay people, what the problems are with the movement. Some of the things that are really different about this book, I think, are that, one, we have articles which criticize the movement. The movement is not perfect. There's problems of elitism, people accusing other people of elitism if they're creative. There's an article on that. People attacking each other. There's an article criticizing the more conservative part of the movement, criticizing the gay churches, criticizing the gay churches marrying people. Now, there's another article I disagree with in part, because I feel that if gay people want to get married and want the blessing of the church, I mean, they should certainly have that right. I mean, I personally agree with the author in that I don't think that gay people should get married and imitate heterosexuality. And one of the other sections that is completely different in the book is the section on Cuba. No book ever on any subject has mentioned homosexuality in Cuba, to my knowledge. Now, this is a very touchy subject. The left looks on Cuba as being the ideal revolution, as being perfect. And nothing can possibly go wrong in Cuba.
Or if they make mistakes, they are honestly trying to struggle, and it was an honest mistake, and there is no... I think what they do is they give Cuba credit for having no ill will, that, you know, that there is corruption in other places, but not there. That in Russia or China or some other places, there are all of these human tendencies to corruption, but everybody in Cuba is an honest revolutionary who tries very hard.
Well, the problem in Cuba, of course, is that the homosexuals are put in rehabilitation camps, which
still?
Is a... I think they've stopped that, but recently, and it's in the book, the Cuban government came out with an official statement saying that they did not want homosexuals in the arts or in education or in anything where they might come in contact and corrupt children. So homosexuals are having a rather hard time there. And Alan does get letters from people in Cuba complaining about what's going on. And this is something that people in the left here in the Venceramas Brigade don't want publicized. Gay people were thrown off the last couple of gay Venceramas Brigades and the regular Venceramas Brigades. They did not want homosexuals to go to Cuba because the homosexuals were discovering things that the government did not want discovered, and they just didn't want to be confronted with homosexuals on the brigade. It wasn't that gay people cut less sugar.
Well, I think that the whole notion of learning about another country by going to a model working commune and staying isolated there and then going on government-sponsored tours, you know, the idea that people think that they have really learned about the revolution and what goes on in Cuba that way seems a little bit pathetic. It's like, a tourist going to the Soviet Union and going on a government-sponsored tour. Or for that matter, I remember once speaking to a bunch of French women who came to the United States. They were involved in education. They were all teachers. And they were being given tours in the American schooling system so they could learn how American education proceeds. Well, you can imagine, you know, what kind of schools were selected and who was selected to talk to them. They did not go to a 600 school in Harlem. They did not have a chance to speak without the benefit of government officials or, you know, institutional officials to, say, somebody at a girls' reformatory.
Well, this happened in Cuba. Of course, the Cuban government did not want the homosexuals to see the rehabilitation camps, which were in effect at that time. And, of course, each group on the boat had already formed into caucuses, and there were women's groups and black groups and Spanish groups, and the gay group had formed. Now, each group in the camp, the work camp where they were staying, presented, made presentations about their philosophy, about what their group was doing. And the Cuban officials came to each group, except when the homosexuals gave their presentation. Because if the Cuban officials came and listened to what the homosexuals had to say, it might appear to be an official recognition of the gay movement, which they did not want to do. I think they were rather disturbed I think it was the 5th Brigade, when the homosexuals did form into their own caucus, because there had always been homosexuals on the brigade, but they had never been open. And this was the first time the homosexuals were visible. And after that, of course, homosexuals were not allowed on the brigade because of the noise they caused.
In other words, anybody who was an open homosexual was not allowed on the brigade.
As far as I know, this has still not been rectified.
Do you think this is due to the influence of the Soviet Union or the patriarchal culture in Cuba in general?
It's more due to, first of all, Cuba is a Catholic country, and there's a whole Catholic tradition against homosexuality. I can't forget that word. If I mispronounce that word, my life is over. And secondly, when the bourgeois government was in Cuba, it just so happened that a lot of homosexuals were in the tourist business and were in this business of catering to the bourgeois tourist industry from North America.
Well, look, Cuba was the whorehouse of the Western Hemisphere. American troops, be they gay or straight, American tourists went down there, spent American dollars, and if they wanted to get a Cuban to do something, getting 10 American bucks for committing fellatio or whatever was 10 large American bucks. My mother was in Cuba during that period. She grew up there, really, from the time she was 7 years old until she was a teenager. And she said everybody thought Americans were, all Americans were rich because they would, the ones that would come down would be ones with tourist dollars to spend. She was suffering from multiple vitamin deficiencies. They took her to a hospital because of the, poverty that she was living in. And she would look around and see these American tourists. Well, temptation for a lot of people was very easy. And if you were gay, you wouldn't mind doing it quite as much, say, as if you were a straight guy.
Well, the thing was that somehow homosexuality became associated with bourgeois tourism. And when the revolution came, along with prostitution and the gambling and the other things that were going on in Cuba, the government decided to eliminate homosexuality. And they thought it was part of decadent bourgeois life. Now, the Soviet Union does take the same line.
I wonder, and the Soviet Union didn't have quite the same problem. I wonder if that's just an excuse, because they don't eliminate heterosexuality on account of prostitution. So why should they eliminate homosexuality on account of gay male prostitution?
It's all tied in with the Latin machismo, too.
I think that it's part of the male culture. One of the things that's in the articles is that the Cuban men are very physical with each other. And there's a lot of touching, and it's part of the Latin culture, a lot of touching and kissing and...
women too.
Very affectionate, but they would not touch the gay men. That was against their machismo, you see, to touch a gay man. It was all right if the man was a real man, in quotes.
And did not offer a threat.
Right, but But a homosexual man could not be touched. The contrast happened when the Vietnamese came over to Cuba. And the Vietnamese didn't really understand what homosexuality was, because it was such an intricate part of their culture that they couldn't distinguish that a heterosexual was that much different from a homosexual. There's a kind of bisexuality among North Vietnamese people. And they really treated the gay people in a friendly way, which really contrasted with the way the Cubans were treating the homosexuals.
I wonder about the North Vietnamese. That's interesting, because we know so little about Vietnamese culture. All we know about, really, is what's going on in the South, which is a corrupt client state of the United States. But we really don't know anything about the traditional Vietnamese culture.
I've heard that it's kind of common practice for men in Vietnam to walk hand in hand through the streets, and I really don't know where how homosexuality is really involved in this, or it's just a cultural.
Men in Africa do it too.
Yeah,
it's sort of that's the way people behave.
Right, and when probably if a Cuban society, people in Cuba would see this, they might immediately think homosexual.
Well, no, not if it was a North Vietnamese, you see.
No, that's right.
I mean, the North Vietnamese can do no wrong.
I think with a lot of people in hearing about the fact that we were criticizing the treatment of homosexuals in Cuba, didn't really understand that we're not condemning Cuba or condemning the movement. But what we're trying to say is that if there is some kind of revolution that gay people are intricate part of in fighting for social change, we're not going to stand by and be shoved into the ovens once there is this change. Now, the homosexuals in Cuba have done this. A lot of them fought for the revolution. And when the revolution came, they were not considered good communists or good revolutionaries because they were homosexuals, and the government turned around and put them in these rehabilitation camps.
Well, I'll tell you, you wouldn't believe it to you know, if you'd been around during the Stalinist period and even now, to read all of the anti-Jewish propaganda that was circulated in the Soviet Union. But fully one quarter of the participants in the revolution around St. Petersburg belonged to the Jewish Bund. And they were one of the in fact, you can read some of the histories of the Soviet Revolution, not the ones that you get out of the Soviet Union, but if you read around a bit. They were instrumental in the revolution, had a long tradition of socialist-type agencies, like the Workers' Circle, which still exists in the United States, Workmen's Circle groups, and stuff like that. You know, there's always some group that can be called, you know, they are not revolutionary enough, whether it's ethnic or homosexual or something. I'm beginning to think that it might be some sort of a pattern. Maybe we have to re-examine what we mean by revolution.
Well, I think if there is a pattern, we have to realize what the shortcomings of past revolutions have been.
But I think we don't realize why. Like we talk, well, this time we're going to make a revolution that will include this group, that group, and the other group.
Not knowing which group will persecute.
Also, not being that clear about the dynamics of revolution.
We still don't know what's happening in China with the homosexuals. The one person whom I know who has been there, who was a part of the ping pong team, when I met him in California, he said to a gay friend of mine, who said, "What's happening with the homosexuals in China?" He said, "Don't ask." So we still don't know there what's happening. Of course, the reason we were so concerned with Cuba is, after all, Cuba is 90 miles away from the United States, and even less if you count the Keys. And the Cuban Revolution is something that people on the New Left feel very close to. It's much closer to our frame of reference than the Russian Revolution or the Chinese Revolution, which happened years before we were born, and which happened outside of our consciousness, and just being more physically removed. So I think that Cuba is a focal point for the new left. And that's why we, as radicals in this book, paid a lot of attention to Cuba. And it's one of the biggest sections in the book.
Also, Cuba is part of Western culture, whereas the Chinese situation is not.
And, I mean, we don't know enough about their culture even to assess what homosexuality means to them.
Well, let's get on to one of these other chapters. One of the things that I think is very important in the book is that instead of a lot of criticism about the movement by gay people, most of the articles in all of the sections are actually personal testimony. And it's really an honest approach to the different situations. That's why perhaps many of them don't agree with each other. It's all individual experience.
I think that we based it on the fact that gay people, like women, have had all their psychiatry, all their anthropology, all their history written by heterosexuals, or people who are posing as heterosexuals, because we don't really know. So what we have left is our experience, and the book is built on that core of experience. And I think that a gay philosophy, if one ever emerges, and I don't think there should be a gay philosophy or a gay line, but whatever philosophy does emerge, and I think it will be diverse, will emerge from our experience as individuals.
Well, frankly, it looks like a delicious book. You know, just looking through the chapter headings and the different articles, like this, Sex and Roles, Gay Revolution and Sex Roles, Cruising, Games Men Play, The Fairy Princess Exposed, Portrait of the Lesbian as a Young Dyke. I must say, our language tends to be very colorful.
Some of those articles are interesting. The Fairy Princess is about older homosexuals who kind of went somewhere over the rainbow and lived in Judy Garland land forever after. And why homosexuals do that and live among their white teacups, and male homosexuals, and why they get into that, and why perhaps maybe they'll never get out of it. And I think that we as younger homosexuals need a more thorough understanding of older homosexuals.
Yeah, there's an article here called Will You Still Need Me When I'm 64? That on the same topic?
Yes. That was by Ralph Schaefer, who incidentally was killed last summer in Los Angeles. He worked in a gay thrift shop. I don't know whether it was like a Hadassah thrift shop or what, but someone came in and shot his head off. And so
they never caught.
Right. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, whom they probably never looked for. And he will never live to be 64, mm-hmm. but he was 42, I think. And he felt that his body was in better shape than when he was 20. And he was quite a nice-looking man, interesting-looking. And he felt that older gay people were left behind, rejected, and there was a kind of youthism that even not only did young gay people go for young gay people, but old gay people want young gay people.
And not each other.
Right.
There's also a youth cult among heterosexuals.
So right.
It's a whole society that
maintains
this.
People.
Yeah.
It's really incredible when you think about it, because while young people have no power in this society, and you know, we don't have money, we don't have much to say about who rules America. Very few people do, but those who do are, you know, old white men. Nevertheless, our bodies are wanted, either on the front lines of Vietnam or on the beds.
Front line of the bedroom.
Right.
It's a real problem in the movement. And I don't think that older gay people should be left behind as something that's unsalvageable or left behind even politely, because the older gay people are part of the movement, and they took, they prepared the way for us, and without them, we never could have liberated ourselves. And I always feel bad that there is now in New York at least, no place for older gay people. I mean, DOB used to take a lot of the older gay people.
Yeah, but I think it's even more than we owe these people a debt for preparing the way. Because I think most people will be glad to acknowledge the debt once it's pointed out to them. You know, they stop deriding people who are in a different politics. And I think there's an awful lot more people who are willing to stop that than there are people who are sitting around saying, you don't agree with me, you're the pig, I'm going to shoot you. You're the counter-revolutionary, you know, to the nearest neighbor. But I think there's an even more profound feeling of sexual rejection, and that's not as easy to deal with somehow as political rejection. You know, the feeling of they don't have children. Most of us don't have children. We're getting old. We're not wanted anymore, either by our bosses or any bosses or certain or not sexually anymore, and you know, no children to demand that they come visit.
Well, I think that a lot of gay people are looking for the solution to that, and I think that one of the probings into that is a very interesting article in the book. I think it's one of the better articles on living together in a gay commune and trying to deal with the problems of living together and perhaps growing old together in a kind of sexual but non-sexual setting, and looking for an alternative to a lifestyle which leaves a lot of gay people old and lonely and friendless, perhaps.
Are there a lot of gay communes, to your knowledge?
Yes. There are a lot all over the country. Yes. I know of a lot of them. Out west, I've heard of, and in Florida, and Alan lives in a, I don't know if he'd call it a commune, it's more like a collective type of thing, but they are going to get farmland and live in western Massachusetts. And I don't know how many, they kind of come and go. I don't know how many there are.
I don't know how long-term they are, really.
Yeah, it could be like a house that's sort of a rotating crash pad, and that's not exactly...
Right.
One of the things that was discovered in the article that they were down to about three people, and was this really a commune with three people, or was it more of a troika set up? I don't know. But I think one of the searchings in the book is for an alternative lifestyle for people to find.
Let us get back to good old Out of the Closet, subtitled Voices of Gay Liberation.
Now, sounds like the Gay Liberation Tabernacle Choir. You can get it at Oscar Wilde, of course, down on Mercer Street. And if not, threaten to bomb your local bookstore if they don't get it. And or you could get it directly from the publisher, Douglas Books, at 905 West End Avenue.
Mm, and it's only $3.95.
Right, it's $3.95 in paperback. There is also a hardcover if you want it gilted in your library forever, $7.95.
Well, I suppose librarians would want that.
Right, librarians. And we found that a lot of gay groups have been ordering hardcovers because they just last longer.
Yeah.
I'd just like to add that this is not a mostly or predominantly male book. At least half the articles were written by women. And it's probably the only such book written by both men and women, not necessarily in cooperation. But I think that it's very important, and a lot of the manifestos, of course, were written predominantly by lesbians, even if they're not signed. And it's a very important book for women, and a very large section is devoted to lesbians and the women's liberation movement, which is something we could discuss.
Okay, you hear that all out there? So, you know, smash the piggy bank, run out and get your copy of Out of the Closets. This is Martha Shelley for Lesbian Nation. Good night.